everyone was afraid of this tax situation. And we went to a broker. We ended up doing a bridge loan on this deal. And a lot of the bridge loan funding was sort of drying up because it was a much busier year than people expected. So a lot of the lenders were just not interested, like they were hitting their caps.
Welcome to Multifamily Deal Lab. We're your host, Dave Lindahl, dissects recent multifamily deals done by his guests. Dave will extract what went right, what went wrong, and a number of key takeaways so your next deal may be more profitable.
All right, welcome everybody. Welcome to another edition of Multifamily Deal Lab, How Deals Get Done. And today I am with a fellow New Englander, Chris Lento. Chris, tell everybody who you are, where you're from.
My name is Chris Lento. I'm from Boston, Massachusetts. I live on the South End, work on out of the Back Bay, and I'm a full-time multifamily real estate investor.
Sweet. All right. So this deal is, we're going to talk about a 60-unit deal that you did in Cary, North Carolina. Before we do that, let's talk about how you decided to go to the Carolinas and how you infiltrated that market, because this is, you've done multiple deals there now. How you really get yourself established in that particular market being from Boston?
So all the deals, I've done three deals in North and South Carolina in the last year, and two of them were off market, and the other one was pseudo off market, meaning it fell out of contract, and we had a good relationship with the broker, and we sort of got it before it went back on the market. But I would say, you know, in general, it's establishing broker relationships with the smaller brokers who don't kind of list everything. So the guys who are very transactional, they know the local market, they know who's has 1031 exchanges coming up that need kind of tight timelines on their transactions, or maybe for other reasons don't want to market their properties cross country. They have a good relationship with their property manager and they don't want to ruin that. They might have other deals in the market, various reasons that they don't want to go on the market, but it's really establishing those relationships over a while. Actually, some of them took a year to even get sort of decent deals coming my way.
Yeah. So a couple of questions. First of all, so are you talking about you get the off-market deals from broker relationship?
Correct.
Okay. And then you said some of them took almost a year to establish a relationship where they're actually getting you some sort of a deal that actually could work.
Oh, yeah.
So talk about that process. What do you do for a year to finally get into the confidence of a broker so you can start doing business?
You know, phone calls. I try to call the brokers that I think are of high value or high potential every 3 weeks and start to establish a relationship with them, find out kind of what they're into that we have in common. Just stay on top of them as far as what they're up to, what kind of deals they have going. I went down and saw a number of deals for a couple properties that I was sort of questionable whether they were going to work out, but good to see the market, good to meet people face to face, have a dinner, and then sort of they can feel you out, you know, I mean, to some degree, it's, they're feeling you out, you're feeling them out. You know, they don't want to give you this great deal that you're going to be super overconfident about to the last minute and then say, I can't raise the money. Like, they don't want that. So they want to know that you close, that you're a real person that will get on a flight and come down there, have the correct questions to ask and know what you're doing. Yeah, I would say phone calls and then occasional visits. And then letting them know what you're doing in other markets. You know, when you're talking to them about the properties that are available, kind of talk about your other property that you have and maybe ask them some questions about problems you're having that they could help.
Are questions about problems that they're having that you can
or that you're having, right? So I'm having a problem with a property in Tallahassee. I could just run it by my broker in North Carolina. It just reinforces the fact that you're acting, you're operating.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a really good point.
People like giving advice.
Absolutely. Yeah. People like to talk for sure. Yeah. People do like to be seen as somebody that's in authority and likes to help out for sure. You had very quickly said finding what you had in common. Could you explain that process? Because that's probably the most important part of establishing a relationship. So when you're finding commonality, what type of commonalities are you finding? Like, what do you have in common with some of the people that you're doing business with specifically?
I have a five-year-old, as we were just talking about. So kids go a long way. I mean, people like talking about the kids. I like talking about the kids. So kids are kind of an easy one.
Family's always the go-to, especially if you're trying to find others, something really, really specific. The family's always there. So what unusual do you have in common with any of these people that when you're like, oh yeah, wow, that's awesome. Me too.
Right. I ski a lot. I kind of travel to ski. So there's a couple of brokers I know that do a lot of skiing. So that's like an endless discussion, right? You can always talk about where you like, where, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
There's a lot you can do there.
Where do you travel to?
Colorado, Utah.
You get away from the icy conditions of New England?
California. Yes. Yeah.
I was going to say
ski here too, but.
I was going to take my kids up to ski during that vacation week last week, but it was so freaking icy. It was like, no, I don't think this is going to be the time when it's going to put their skis on for the first time. Right. Yeah, good. All right. So, I mean, the most important part about building a relationship with somebody new is to establish something that you have in common that completely outside of real estate. And they kind of focus on that. And when you do, it just creates a bond in the relationship. And eventually you start becoming friends because you both have a common situation, common life, common passion.
And I think it has to be authentic too, right? Like, so I'm not into sports and a lot of people are. You can't fake it, you know?
No, the BS meter goes up right away.
Yep.
Yeah. All right, good. So we're going to talk about 60 units in Cary, North Carolina. So how did you get that deal?
So that was an off-market deal. I went down to Raleigh to look at a different property that this broker brought me that was also off-market. And he was just really bullish about the Raleigh, Cary, basically the Research Triangle area. Very New England property that I went to look at. It was built in 1930. It was 67 units, brick building. Like you'd see these in Newton and Brookline all day long. So I could relate to it, you know, and right in downtown, so a nice neighborhood. And I just could not make the numbers work. There's not a value add
just,
here.
Just like in New England.
And to be honest, they probably, someone bought it for what he was saying it would go for. They're probably going to make it work, but not everyone has the same underwriting criteria or the same return requirements. So that's fine. But I just could not, comps weren't working out and the value add wasn't there to justify the rent increases that were needed to make the property pencil. So I couldn't make it work. I worked with him on it. He was sort of trying to convince me how it would work. And I was pushing back or accepting what he said and then providing my perspective. So we went back and forth on that one for a while. And I think it was sort of like a feeling out process. And then after that, while we were there, he said, hey, I have a different owner who's thinking about putting two different properties that have just done really well for him in the last year. He just bought them, but he's already looking to exit because they're just doing phenomenal. While you're here, just drive by him. He gave me the addresses. So I checked out those two properties.
I just want to mention the importance of knowing how to underwrite. And we talk about this all the time, especially people that are just joining our mentorship program. We do the onboarding call and I talk about the fact that the very first thing you do is you learn how to underwrite. You go through our Apartment Training Academy underwriting course. You go to immersion, you know, that first day and you got to know your numbers because number one, the brokers very quickly realize that when you don't know what you're talking about, you don't know what you're talking about. Your investors, if you do get into a deal with bad numbers, you're not going to be able to give your investors their return and that's going to be a nightmare. And then thirdly, you're not going to make any money. So, I mean, underwriting is the key before you make any type of communications. So when you said you were going back and forth with this broker, and you realized you weren't going to be able to make this deal pencil, and the broker was giving you reasons why it would pencil, and then you respectfully listened to them, and then you would go back and say, well, this is what I'm seeing, and like kind of disagreeing with them in a nice way, right? And at the same time, in his mind, he's thinking to himself, shit, this guy knows what he's doing. Okay, so he realizes that this one really doesn't work, so I'm going to show him one that probably would work. So that's why it's so important to know how to underwrite.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Yeah, and on that one, you know, like I said, even getting a lending on the one that eventually sold would be tough. So yeah, you have to underwrite first. So that's how I found it. So then I checked out the couple of the other ones that he mentioned and I said, what are they looking for on both of them? And we kind of went back and forth on those. And then it turned out that the seller of this property bought it about 8 months before. The numbers he penciled it at were being dramatically exceeded by his renovations. So he had penciled that rents were going to increase by 150 a unit on the turns and they were going up by like 250.
Oh, sweet.
I mean, it was all during the pandemic and that area had 20%+ rent increases. And they had, in the meantime, grown their portfolio massively. So this 60 unit was like small change for what they were going after. Mm-hmm. So they were like, all right, we can hit our number on year one. Let's just get out of it. And we're trying to take down this 350 unit that we want to focus our effort on.
Oh, so they're in and out of this deal in year one?
In year one, yeah.
Wow. Nice.
So I think really we got it because it was off market. They said, if these guys can hit our number and they can close in a pretty tight timeline because they wanted to close after the 1 year anniversary that they've owned it to get long-term capital gains, but before the end of the year, because they didn't want to get hit with any potential capital gains changes that may be coming our way.
Yep.
So it was a tight timeline that I had to hit. And they were like, they can do those two things, then we're good.
Did they ask you for any money apart?
We had no hard money through the inspection phase. But once we hit inspection phase, there was 120K hard.
After inspection.
But the tough part with that, there was a risk here, was that we had to close between December 20th and December 31st. Now, had we missed that December 31st, there was probably a negotiation to be had, but there was nothing in writing that we could really go back on.
How many days was that from the first day you went into contract?
We had plenty of time. It was like,
oh, yeah,
something like that. So we sort of had time to get the lending in place. So it wasn't like it was a super short runway. It was just a narrow target.
Yeah, that you had to hit because otherwise the deal would have hit the skids. I remember I had a similar type of a deal quite a few years ago, four different partners, and they were looking to get out of their partnership and they needed to close by the end of the year. And we were using a private equity company. And right at the very last minute, they screwed the deal up. I'm like, holy crap, you know, we're not going to be able to close. And we're like at the mercy of these four guys. And one of them actually wanted to do a 1031 exchange. So he needed more time. So the other three like worked their way out of the deal and the other guy got to stay. And we actually didn't end up closing that deal for almost a year later because this guy needed to find a property. He got all these different extensions and But when we didn't hit the date, it was like, oh, panic, you know, we're going to lose this deposit.
honestly, that's where we were too. So we had a very similar situation where I think we had a fair price for the property. And then the lending, it turned out we weren't the only people that needed a close by the end of the year.
Oh, yeah,
because
right.
Because everyone was afraid of this tax situation. And we went to a broker. We ended up doing a bridge loan on this deal. And a lot of the bridge loan funding was sort of drying up because it was a much busier year than people expected. So a lot of the lenders were just not interested. Like they were hitting their caps.
Yeah, exactly.
So we hit like a small number of lenders who were even interested, and the rates were okay, but leverage was less than we had been kind of expecting based on conversations with some of the lenders earlier. It was just things were drying up basically. So we did have a lot of hurdles to deal with the lending. I don't think we were in danger of closing on time, but it was tense.
That's something for people to keep in mind going into, I know this is being recorded at the beginning of 2022 in March, but I mean, thinking if you go into any deals in October of this year,
right.
What happens is the lenders hit their caps, meaning that they've lent out the amount that they wanted to for the year. So they're not as motivated to do any more lending, which seems like a strange thing because it's going to make money, but still they're not motivated to do lending, number one. And number two, you're competing against everybody else that wants to close by the end of the year. So it can be a stressful time. A lot of different things you got to take into consideration.
Yeah, that was stressful towards the end of that close.
One other thing I wanted to have you explain is, so you knew that you could increase the rents by $250, say, on each of those doors after you did the rehab. How did you know that? What did you use as comps?
These guys had already started a value add program. So they effectively bought this property from someone who'd owned it for 30 years and was really managing it, like kind of mom and pop. They kept the CapEx in good shape, like the roofs were good and there was no major deferred maintenance, but the units hadn't been renovated. The rents were below market. It was just sort of shabby. So this last owner came in and started an interior value add program and basically demonstrated the plan. So they did 25 of the 60 units. So I could just take their rent roll basically. And one thing that actually really helped in this deal is in that 90 days, the rents they were getting for their turned units, because they were still doing the turns while we were closing, which was interesting. And I think they may have thought we weren't going to come through. I don't know why they did that, but they turned 4 units in that 90 days. After we were under contract. And those new leases were at or above the projections that we had. So that was, it gave us a lot of confidence.
Awesome. So you closed this about 3 months ago. And how much per door did you say you were putting in? Well, you were finishing up the rehab, right?
Yeah, so we're putting in about 8,000 to 9,000 a door interior, and then we're putting in another 5,000 a door exterior. We're putting in a dog park, we're updating the playground, we're doing parking lot improvements, you know, a number of because what they hadn't done is really changed the look and feel of the place.
Yeah.
So there was actually no sign at all. Like it had been knocked down by like a drunk driver 5 years ago or 10 years ago or some point. So there was no sign. There was no kind of building signs. Numbers were old. It just didn't have a good
wow, so they started on the interior when they were doing the rehab.
They started the interior. Yeah.
That's interesting. That's a classic mistake, yeah. Actually. Yeah. Always
it's opposite of what I would have thought. But I guess one thing it did allow them to do, though, was demonstrate those rent increases.
That's true.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's kind of opposite the way you see most people do it.
Just so everybody knows, we didn't do this at the beginning, but it's a 60-unit property built in 1973. It was a $12 million purchase price. Was that the actual purchase price, $12
million? It was, yep.
All right. Yep. So what's your all-in cost?
The all-in cost, it's going to be $650 in CapEx. So $12,600.
You're going to raise those rents by approximately $250 per unit. What's the value of the property when you're done?
It's going to be $18 million.
And what's the projected time of completion?
Between 3 and 5 years, but I'm thinking it's probably going to be 3. And that $18 million, I'd have to look at the model to see what it needs to be at sellout in 3 years to meet all my projections. It was going to be $18 million in 5 years was the underwriting.
When you did your projection, did you increase the cap rate on your exit price?
Yeah, I increased it from the market cap that I bought it at to by half a point.
So that's like a $5 million profit in 5 years.
Yeah.
That's a sweet deal. Plus all the cash flow.
Right. Now, this is a relatively low cash flow deal. It's got a pref of 6%. And part of that was I didn't want to make it overly complicated by having like a tiered pref, 6-year 1, 7-year 2, kind of like, but the in-place cash flow was just low in the first year because of we're doing all these turns and raising the rent. So I wouldn't have done this deal, I think, in a market that I wasn't so confident in. I mean, this area of North Carolina has just exploded. 3,000 jobs from Apple are going in there. Google has a new major office going in. I mean, just going to the area, there's cranes everywhere. It's a very nice area that's getting nicer. Had this market not been as dynamic, I wouldn't have been as confident.
Yeah, I agree.
And I don't think I would have been able to get investors, honestly, at a 6 round.
It's difficult, but these days, there's a lot of dry powder out on the sidelines waiting to get into deals.
Sure.
It's also how you train anybody that's got a 401k, you know, or in a pension plan, and they're getting way less than that. So they're happy to get a 6 pref, you know, but then other investors that are used to getting 8 to 10 cash on cash returns, they're not so happy. So I guess it's how, you know, slice and dice and segment your list and where you get your investors. So where did you get your investors for this deal for a 6K, so 6 prep?
So I've been kind of cultivating a list of investors for the last 3 years. I raised about a third of the capital needed for this. And then I've been working with a builder here in Boston. I've been investing with him for about 5 years, and then we sort of have been partnering on deals for the last couple of years because he's got a pretty good investor network. And he always wanted to get into multifamily. Actually, I think you met him, Brad. We came up and talked to him at some point.
I think he did. Was he at the mastermind?
I think we just...
You guys walked through the office, right?
Yeah.
I remember.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we've been partnering on deals where he raises like 2/3 of the equity and I primarily operate. And then we both take the loan, deal with the loan.
Oh, excellent.
So good. That's how he raised.
Good partnership. Where's your favorite place to find equity for your deals?
I would prefer to keep growing my investor network to just have a number of investors. You mean where I find the investors?
That's what I'm talking about.
A lot of different ways to find equity, right? I mean, you can partner with people that just want to raise. You can.
What about for your own personal investor network? Where's your favorite place to populate that, or how's your favorite way to do it?
Really spiraling out from friends and family to like friends of friends, and you can kind of see like as those specific friends or acquaintances that are interested in this type of thing get more involved. Well, they have friends that are more like that. Like, let's just say I have 20 people that I think might be interested in my social network. A good amount of them aren't going to be because they're risk averse. They're not into new things. They don't have that kind of money laying around, what have you. But then once you find the people that are, they tend to have friends or acquaintances that are also interested in different alternative investments.
Birds of a feather.
Right, exactly. So sort of like then speaking to them, hey, do you have any other friends or work colleagues that'd be interested in this kind of thing? And they're always excited because they're happy about the investment. So they're like, yeah, of course. Like, I'd love to get somebody else involved in this. So yeah. that's kind of viral sort of effect.
Yeah, it's a great effect. Let's talk about what was the most challenging aspect of this particular deal.
This deal was the financing. The financing was difficult. We sort of got down to one bridge lender and they kind of knew that we were the only one that they were talking to. And I feel like they just feed us to death. Mm. I mean, I know bridge loans are more expensive than agency debt, but it just felt like they were adding on. So just dealing with the lender's requirements, I think the biggest hurdle was very sort of last minute. They came in and said, oh, well, our underwriting wants 20% of the equity raise to come from the sponsors, not including the fee acquisition fee.
Wow.
So we're like, well, I mean, that's a huge swing. You know, I was planning to take a certain amount of cash from the table and now me and my partner bring 20%. Like, that's crazy. So we were able to try to figure out what they were getting at that. They all of a sudden threw in a lot of these weird requirements. Like, they were worried we're crowdfunding it. They were worried that we were doing, I forget the name of the program, but there's a program where you can get people to invest in real estate in exchange for them to get visas.
Oh yeah, something like the 505B program.
Yeah, they were concerned about that. So all these kind of requirements came out of nowhere. And so once we found out what they were concerned about, we said, hey, look, this is not a million people investing $5 on the internet for this. And we're not shopping this in China for visas. This is a private network that we're going to friends and family. You're going to see a lot of Lentos on the list. You're going to see some my partner's family members. What can we do? So we ended up getting them. They agreed to sort of ignore the acquisition fee. So just forget about that. And if we could bring 20% of like close friends and family, which we already had, was in the list. So that's satisfied their underwriters in the end. But that was kind of a hairy week.
Yeah, sounds like a small shop to be, you know,
posting
things like that.
It was strange. And they did a lot of other things. They had a certain title company that they wouldn't work with. They required us to put our LLC in Delaware when we had already set it up in North Carolina.
You know why that is, like, don't you?
Yeah.
That's so they can get at you if something happens to the deal.
Right. There was just a bunch of little stuff like that was just, we had to deal with.
All right. Well, Chris, this is the end of the Deal Lab podcast. Chris, I want to thank you for being here. And for those that are watching live, you can start asking questions at this particular point. So anybody can meet us at www.rementor.com.
This has been another edition of Multifamily Deal Lab. If watching on YouTube, please be sure to hit the like button, the subscribe button, so you don't miss the next session, and review the contact links on this page.